as the Inner Germany border. And it was really an amazing thing. As unbelievable as it may sound, that barrier was 836 miles long. 836 miles. If you've been to Texas, it's as far, that's as far as from here to Dallas, Texas, and 200 miles beyond. That's a long, long border. And it became an impenetrable border. And let me tell you why I use that word. Along that border, they cleared, of course, an area about 1,500 feet wide for the entire length of the 836 miles. And in that cleared area, they put up barbed wire fences and mesh fences that were virtually impossible to climb over. They also plowed up strips of ground all up and down the border that a vehicle could not travel over. And just to be sure, they also erected some vehicle traps that no vehicle could get by. And they supplied it with anti-personnel mines. These mines were installed along about half of the border's length, and they included 1.3 million Soviet-made mines scattered along that border. Plus, there were about 60,000 anti-personnel mines, directional anti-personnel mines, that were set off by a tripwire, and that activated a kind of a horn-shaped device that shot shrapnel up to almost 400 feet, more than the length of a football field, right along the fence where the tripwire had been bothered. Much of the border was illuminated at night. They had a lot of towers along the border for guards. They had searchlights. Much of the area was patrolled by vicious dogs. Would you believe German shepherds? And the worst part, though, was that the border was patrolled by 60,000 machine gun toting East German soldiers with orders to shoot, to kill anybody trying to traverse that territory. It took a lot to contain a country of people wanting freedom from communism, the virtual slavery that they were being forced to live under. And before all of this actually got into place, people were sneaking across the border. A total estimate of 80,000 people managed to escape out of East Germany and into West Germany. Another 1,000 or so tried to and were killed in the process. 1,000 people who knew they were risking their lives but felt that their attempt to escape from unacceptable conditions was worth risking their life. Many people tried to make a dash for it by simply running. And of course, very few made it that way. Even though some were very ingenious, they devised a contraption to attach to their shoes to enable them to climb up those mesh fences. But again, that was seldom successful because of all the armaments that they had operating to prevent that. Others tried to charge their way through the barriers with armored vehicles. They actually took regular cars and mounted bulldozer blades on the front and all sorts of contraptions to try to get through that. Some even tried tunneling under the entire thing. But that usually, of course, was not successful either. One fellow even built a mini submarine and went around the end up in the Baltic Sea and actually was able to travel along the coast just off the shore and make it from East Germany into West Germany. One woman even swam that same route. It took her over 40 hours, but she made it. A lot of things were tried. But let me tell you about a couple of men who devised a plan to escape by a very unusual method. Peter Strelzik and Gunter Wetzel resided with their wives and children in a small town of Posedek, East Germany. They were both fairly well off. They were fairly well educated and kind of semi-retired. And they were both technical guys. They liked solving technical, mechanical type problems, puzzles, and so forth. But they and their wives and children wanted out of that country. They wanted out of what they called a hermetically sealed workers and farmers republic. Strelzik said, "The hypocrisy of the whole system in the East repelled us. You are subjected to constant propaganda and lying. You are not free to read what you please, to say what you think, or to travel anywhere except other communist countries, and not always that. Worst of all, it turns your children into opportunists and hypocrites." Now, they knew their chances of crossing the border on the surface were virtually nil. That was entirely too risky. They thought, well, the only other way is to fly over it. They thought about building a helicopter, but they realized it would take much too powerful an engine to lift a helicopter and four adults and four children. So that they knew that that just wouldn't work. And one of them came up with a brilliant idea. He said, "Why don't we do a balloon?" The other one said, "Hey, that sounds good. Let's do." One thing, neither one of them knew anything about balloons, but they could learn. So they both went to the only used bookshop in town and to the library in their town and began reading and studying all they could find out about ballooning, anything even remotely related. And they did some calculating. As I said, they were both technically educated, and they figured that the eight people, together with the gondola, the part that attaches to the bottom of the balloon for them to ride in, plus the gas containers, the burner to heat the air to make the balloon rise, all of that together with the balloon itself would weigh about 1,650 pounds. Now, that's a lot of weight to lift up into the air. And they calculated that to lift that much weight, the balloon would require a volume of over 70,000 cubic feet. And to get that volume, they would need almost 9,000 square feet of material to build the balloon from. Where are you going to get 9,000 square feet of any kind of material, especially in a virtually third world country like East Germany, where their policemen and spies and so forth watching everything that everybody does? Well, they were pretty smart about it. They went to a nearby town, and they were able to purchase enough cotton cloth to make that size of balloon. And, of course, the clerk in the department store where they went in and requested that much was kind of startled. "What are you going to do with that much material?" And they explained that they were from a camping club, and this was needed to line their tents with. So they got away with it. They were able to get it. Of course, it cost them about $750, but they did it anyhow. Then for the next 2 weeks, Wetzel spent his every day sewing the pieces he'd cut out of that material together to make that balloon. He sewed it on an old-time foot-operated sewing machine, I'm sure you're all familiar with. He would sew every day until his hands and his feet became so swollen that he couldn't continue. And then he'd rest and start back the next day. And it took him 2 weeks of doing this to sew it together. But when he was done, he had a bag that was 50 feet wide and 66 feet long. And in the meantime, Strelzik had been building the gondola and the burner system. So when they were done, they started searching for a place to test all this. Remember, it's got to be totally out of sight. They couldn't just get out on the town square and check out this balloon. They had to sneak it out for a test. They found a small opening in a forest about 10 miles from town. And on a dark night, they hauled their stuff out there, stretched the balloon out onto the ground, and fired up their mechanism and started pumping it into the balloon. And it didn't do anything. It would not lift at all. So they took it to a nearby cliff and actually dropped it over the edge of the cliff and left it hanging about 75 feet. And again, attached their device and started blowing hot air. It would not hold it. They finally realized that the material that they, or that the blower that they were using was not powerful enough. It wasn't getting enough hot air in. So they built a new burner apparatus, used a motorcycle engine to help give it more power. So they took it back and tried again, and still no luck. The problem was that the material they were using was too porous. They'd blow the air in, it would seep through the wall of the balloon. So they obviously had wasted all the time they had spent building that balloon because it was useless since it wouldn't hold air. That's discouraging. They had gone to a lot of trouble and a lot of expense and a lot of effort to do this, and they realized all of a sudden it's just not working. And Wetzel quit. He said, I'm not fooling with it anymore. But Strelzik would not give up. He continued to work on making it better and making it right. And he worked through the winter, and he worked through the spring, and he rebuilt the burner system. And he actually acquired more material and rebuilt, using a different type of material, rebuilt the entire bag. But he knew he didn't have enough lifting power for all eight people. And, of course, Wetzel had already given up and bowed out of it anyhow. But he took his family, Strelzik did, on the night of July the 4th, 1979, he and his family headed to that clearing. The rebuilt burner system worked very well in the balloon, and it ascended to over a mile high just almost immediately, no problem. And a nice breeze was blowing right toward West Germany, which is just what he needed. So it carried the balloon along just fine until they ran into a cloud. And the vapor in the cloud turned to moisture on the surface of the balloon, and it soaked the balloon, and it came straight down to the ground. When they landed, they were in the what's called death strip, still in East Germany. They were only about 200 yards from the border and from freedom. Well, Strelzik was still determined. They carefully picked their way across that no man's land that they had landed in and managed to escape from the area without tripping any of those landmines or the shrapnel shooting devices or whatever. They made it back to the clearing, got their vehicle, and returned home. But of course, the balloon, the gondola, still lay right there in the wide open next to the border. And naturally it was discovered the next morning, and the authorities knew then someone was trying to escape by balloon, of all things. Well, Strelzik kind of panicked. He just really didn't know what to do. He knew that they would be searching for anything suspicious, and he was afraid of being detected. He went back to Wetzel and explained to him what happened and convinced him that the lifting power of the burning apparatus was fine. It's just that the material the balloon was made of was not acceptable, and they really needed to build another balloon. And apparently he was convincing because Wetzel agreed to join him in another effort. This time working together, they designed a bag with twice the volume, 141,256 cubic feet. This one was 65 feet in diameter and 82 feet high. That was the largest balloon that had ever been built in Europe. And that's where balloons started in the 1600s in the country of France. But they didn't have anything nearly that big. To find that much material, they couldn't just go to one department store to order it. They had to go to towns all over East Germany. They literally traveled more than 2,000 miles crisscrossing the country, getting a little material here, a little material there. And finally, they wound up with enough to build that size of balloon. And Wetzel went back to his sewing machine and started again. But by this time, he had put an electric motor on it. So it sewed a lot better and a lot faster. And he used all of that material and built that new balloon that size. And in the meantime, Strelzik built a new blower, a new flamethrower, and a new gondola to replace the one that had to be left behind in no man's land. And within 6 weeks, they were able to go, or ready to go again. All they had to do now was to wait for the right wind and the right weather. And that came along on September the 15th, and they loaded up the balloon, the gondola, all their apparatus, the wives and the children, and headed to their clearing in the woods to make another attempt. This time things worked really well. They turned up the blower, and in just 10 minutes the balloon was full and began to rise. The breeze blew just right, and it carried them at 18 miles per hour toward West Germany. They passed the border successfully. In a nearby town in West Germany, two constables were out patrolling in the wee hours of the morning, and they saw a strange lighted object in the air, all looked like about a mile high, and it was coming down fast. They traveled to where they thought it would probably land, just check it out, see what it was, and by the time they got there, two men dashed out of the bushes and said, "Where are we? Is this the West?" And the constable assured them, "Yes, you're in the West." And they called out to the wives and children and said, "Come on out and bring that bottle of champagne." And they had read that that's what all balloonists did when they landed, was break out the champagne. Well, as the saying goes, they accomplished their goal, and as fairy tale writers would write it, they lived happily ever after. It was a great accomplishment. The men were excited and thrilled to be in a country where they could have freedom and could hopefully see their dreams come true. Now that's an interesting story just in its own, if there were nothing to be learned from it. But brethren, there are some lessons that can be learned from their experience that I'd like to share with you this afternoon that I think can be very helpful for us as individuals. The first lesson is that they had a goal. Now, a few weeks ago, I talked at some length about goals, and we considered how important they are. They had a clear-cut goal. They knew exactly what they wanted to accomplish, and that goal drove them to continue doing whatever it took to get the job done, to achieve their mission. And we need to be the same way. We also have goals. We talked about that. But we've got our one main overall encompassing goal, and that is, as we phrase it, to make it into God's kingdom. And that goal should be so vivid and so real to us that it drives us just like the men's goal drove them to do whatever was necessary to accomplish our mission. In 1 Corinthians 2, 9 and 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9, in the New Living Translation it reads this way, "This is what the scriptures mean when they say, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, and no mind has imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. But to us that God revealed these things by his Spirit, for his Spirit searches out everything and shows us God's deep secrets." And in Hebrews 2, verse 6, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 6, 6 through 8, again in the New Living Translation. "What are mere mortals that you should think about them? Or a son of man that you should care for him? Yet you made them only a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You gave them authority over all things." Brethren, the better we can grasp the reality of our goal, the better off we will be. The more we realize the glory and the magnificence of just what God has in store for us, then the more we'll be inspired to put forth the effort that we need to make it there. How can we do that? Here are some suggestions. First of all, study about the world tomorrow, about the world beyond today, whatever, God's kingdom. Study about it. Do you remember the book by Mr. Armstrong entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like? That book, if you happen not to still have your copy, can be obtained online. You can go online and look it up, read it online, or actually even download it and have it from now on. I think even a hard copy can probably still be obtained. Also, in addition to that, we have booklets to read and reread about the world tomorrow, about God's kingdom. Talk about it. Discuss it with your family. Discuss it with fellow brethren. Keep it on your mind. Remind yourself occasionally just how fantastic it's going to be. Meditate about it. Doing these things will definitely help you to do your best to prepare for it. And the second point or lesson that we can learn from Wetzel and Strelzik, they had to study to prepare for their mission. Remember I mentioned that they went to the only used bookstore in town and the library and studied and learned what they had to about ballooning in order to make the attempt. And it's the same way with us. We need to study in preparation for our job in God's kingdom. And the third point is they certainly had drive. And like thousands of millions or maybe even millions of their fellow countrymen, they were totally fed up with their political and social environment. Are you fed up with your current political and social environment? I certainly am. And yet, we know that there's not really much we can do about that. Not much at all. But there is one thing we do know. It's not going to stay this way forever. There's a better time coming. And let's let the knowledge of that fact drive us toward accomplishing our goal. Another principle that these determined men demonstrated was resourcefulness. They certainly were resourceful. You will recall they spent many hours obtaining the parts that they needed, the materials that they needed to construct their escape vehicle. Remember, they drove hundreds of miles to obtain what they needed. As a matter of fact, the details of how they went about acquiring all that stuff is just almost beyond belief. It reads more like a fiction novel or something rather than something that actually happened. Well, they were resourceful, and we too can be resourceful. We know how valuable certain resources can be. We all use different versions of the Bible. We all use Bible commentaries or Bible dictionaries or other books and booklets that are related to our preparation. Hopefully we all take advantage of those. And then there's a whole other area of resources that we can avail ourselves of, and that's the ones online. For example, on the church's website, we have a lot of things that we can utilize. We can, for example, we can see archived sermons. We have study papers, articles, booklets, archived telecasts, the Bible commentary. How many use the Bible commentary on the website? A wonderful tool. Not much is said about it, but it's fabulous. Excellent resource. And then there are other valuable Bible-related sites that we can go to, like eSword and Bible Hub and some others. As a matter of fact, with a little research, you'll find there's more out there than you can possibly take advantage of. But probably the main lesson that we can learn from these men's experience is perseverance. You know, it would have been easy for them to just give up when that first balloon would not hold air. I mean, they had done a lot of work and put a lot of effort and thought and time into that. And all to no avail, the balloon just didn't work. A lot of people would say, forget it and drop it and be done with it. But not these guys. They kept trying. And then it would have been easy for them to give up when their hot air apparatus was not strong enough to lift the balloon. Again, after all that work and thought they had it worked out, and no go. It would have been easy for them to give up, certainly, when that first attempt failed and they came that close, the Stressel and his family came that close to losing their lives. Over and over, their efforts were thwarted. And finally, Wetzel did quit. He gave up. But Stretzel did not. He wouldn't give up. And as we related, he eventually persuaded Wetzel to try again. And the results was they both made it along with their families. That part reminded me of the scripture in James 5:20. In the New Living Translation, you can be sure that whoever brings the sinner back will save that person from death and bring about the forgiveness of many sins. You know, it is hard to keep on keeping on when things get really difficult. When it just seems like nothing will work out right. But that's when our mettle is really being tested. That's when it's being tested to see if we have what it takes. Now, these fellows obviously had what it takes, and the result of their efforts were freedom and a new way of life for them and their families. Just like Strelzik and Wetzel, we also have a desperate escape attempt to make. We hope to escape this society, this world. We hope to be freed from its slavery, from the influence and the pull that it has on us. Now, our heroes overcame barbed wire, vicious dogs, deadly mines, and machine gun patrols, all devices of entrapment thrown up by the East Germans. And likewise, we've got to overcome some things, some devices thrown up by our enemy, you know who. Things like bad attitudes, health challenges, persecution by acquaintances and relatives, and perhaps employers, as well as fleshly pulls and physical temptations. But if we overcome these obstacles in our life, then the results for us will be eternal life and a position in the government of God in the world tomorrow forever. Galatians 6 and verse 8, and that one I want to read from the King James Bible. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 8. It says, "For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting." And brethren, did you recognize those principles that I just went over that they applied? Fixing a goal, education or studying to prepare for accomplishing that goal, drive to get the job done no matter what, resourcefulness, and perseverance. How many recognize where those things come from? Sure, those are five of the seven laws of success, as detailed in Mr. Armstrong's booklet, The Seven Laws of Success. And by the way, that too is still available to be read online, or once again, even a hard copy can be obtained. You can even go online and hear old sermons by Mr. Waterhouse if you got the time. Brethren, the days of unleavened bread are rapidly approaching, as we say. They're less than 4 weeks away. And we can't wait till that time to start thinking about the meaning of those days. We need to begin right now, if we haven't already, to start to concentrate on the meaning of the days and to prepare spiritually for them through extra prayer and study to get into the right frame of mind. Wetzel and Strelzik succeeded in their effort, and they had to do it alone with no help. We can also succeed in our effort, but we have God's help to do so. You know there are numerous scriptures that explain or reaffirm that promise that God is with us no matter what we have to go through. One thing to help us in preparing for the upcoming Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread is to restudy John chapters 13, 14, 15, and 16. Carefully reading and meditating on these very important teachings from Christ can definitely help to get us into the special frame of mind that we need to for these days, for this special week of what I call spring training, which God has sanctified for us. As I said, it's coming up very soon, and we need to be ready for it. If we don't start preparing now, it will slip up on us, and what we gain from it will be significantly less than if we prepare diligently. Let's resolve to get ready and ensure that these spring holy days are the most profitable that we've ever had.